Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we'll be talking with Professor of Law at Duke Law School, Dr. Barack Richmond, about patient bills, contracts, and consent. Have you ever gotten a confusing bill?
I have. I probably have been the cause of several confusing bills.
Cause of more than a few.
It sounds like Dr. Richmond could be a lawyer. Contracts.
Yes, yes.
Consent and, sounds like ethics.
And wrote an article in the New England Journal, and we are looking forward to having this conversation with him.
Well, first, we're going to have some important research that matters, Christy, about the recent nationwide meningitis outbreak and some research on that.
And we're going to talk about laughter as a form of exercise. Ha ha. Oh, no, don't get you started.
Oh, no. Then we're going to talk about the recent policy legislation in New York City about obesity and drink size and a commentary.
And we're going to talk about our cancer patients' hopes for chemotherapy too high or not based on the reason for the chemotherapy. Interesting question.
Well, it looks like we're kind of going up and down and sideways, but these are really important, Christine. Let's talk about the very first one, which is this nationwide outbreak of meningitis as a result of spinal shots and other shots into joints by contaminated prednisone from a compounding pharmacy in Massachusetts.
And what they did was they followed the Sentinel case and found—
Sentinel?
Sorry, they found the—
That's the where it came from.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
To try to figure out which patients were at highest risk and what were the contributing factors, and did find that people who were injected with the medicine within the 6-week time period between mid-September and late October were at the greatest risk for developing this kind of meningitis from it.
And we know that this meningitis has decimated so many people and families and communities, and it really was nationwide in terms of potentially its impact because the compounding pharmacy was distributing this to so many states, these medications. And I guess, Christy, you know, when we think about one of the take-home lessons here is, what is the real risk when we do procedures? And one of them, certainly for many procedures, is a risk of infection. And perhaps we have to really talk about that risk, even though in most cases it's not that strong, not like this.
Well, and in most procedures, the physicians or providers are going through a sterile technique and other things about the procedure to reduce that risk. But there should be a conversation before you sign and give permission for any procedure about the risks, and that almost always, you're right, Adam, includes infection. And how is the doctor trying to reduce this? Where is the doctor getting the medicine from?
And we assume that most of the doctors, if not all of them in these cases, were doing safe procedures, but, you know, buying the medications in this case from a compounding pharmacy that really perhaps should have come from a regulated, more regulated pharmacy. These are things we have to be aware of, and we're learning all the time. This is sad. I think, Christy, we probably need to do a whole show about this issue.
We absolutely do. Well, let's go to our next research that matters, and this is about laughter. You know, my mom tells me often, she'll call and say, are you laughing? You know, just trying to say, you know, if you laugh, you're going to live longer and life is more fun, and I think she's right.
Well, you know, I'm not going to argue with mothers
don't,
or grandmothers
argue with my
ever.
Mother.
And I'm not going to argue with you, Christy, either. And you know, I hate laughing, as you know, our listeners know here. But it is intrinsically good, isn't it?
It is. And this is a study trying to link that to changes in the body. It was a study done at Oxford University of a large group of undergraduate men and women looking to see what effect watching a funny video compared with just a plain dry documentary had on pain thresholds.
Yeah, and they wanted to see if the endorphin, those chemicals in the brain that get released when something pleasurable happens, in this case, laughing, these are some of the same chemicals that get released that can protect against pain. And so perhaps the laughing actually, as a form of exercise, can protect against pain. I found this really interesting.
They measured their pain thresholds by figuring out how long they could tolerate a tight blood pressure cuff around their arm, and then had them watch the two videos to see what would happen. And I love the results. I love that the pain thresholds went higher for the people who watched the funny videos, but especially that the people who watched the videos in groups and were laughing with other people had more dramatic impact on their pain thresholds than the people just watching it by themselves.
I'm not sure what we do with this fully.
Well, it makes me want to watch funny movies at the theater.
Before we have a painful procedure. But it does suggest that anything we can do to really discuss and display laughter and into our daily routines may help us in some of the more painful moments of our lives. That would be one take-home.
That would be. And, you know, another take-home message is that my mom is usually right.
I like that.
Hey.
Hope you're listening. Okay, let's talk about our very next research that matters about the legislation about obesity in New York City, where they regulated drink size and taxing higher sized drinks to cut down on obesity.
And the real controversy here is one of believing that we should make differences in childhood obesity and obesity in America through educating people that they shouldn't drink sugar drinks versus making real policy change.
This was an article by columnist Jane Brody, also I think in the New England Journal of Medicine, but talked about the need for legislation in addition to education, using the example of cigarette smoking. And while I agree in general that that is a good model, you educate before you legislate, I'm not sure I fully think that this particular piece of legislation, because I think there's a cutoff like at 32 ounces or something.
Well, they did. They limited, taking effect March 12th, limited to 16 ounces the size of sugar-sweetened soft drinks that were available just at regular restaurants, street carts, and movie theaters, sporting events, that type of thing, to make them smaller. And, I mean, considering that 7 to 15% of the calories in our diet come from just sugar beverages, just empty calories, I think it's a step in the right direction. I think you educate and you make steps to limit our choices a little bit.
Well, it makes me think of when I go to the bagel place, can I only get one bagel? When I get more than two bagels or three bagels, because bagels have over 400 calories sometimes in them. So if I think that we really can do everything we can, and the consumers will dictate whether or not a 44-ounce super big gulp with 533 calories.
But who are the consumers they're aiming at? It's children. Children in the United States consume 3 times as many calories from sugar-sweetened beverages than a study comparing children in the Netherlands. So, I mean, no wonder we're bigger. But in this case, the consumers are children.
Well, I think you hear a little bit of disagreement, unusual, between Christy and I, but she's probably right. That's the way we can get along here. And let's talk about, though, between right, this last research that matters, Christy, about chemotherapy and advanced interventions for patients with cancer, an article that was in the Annals of Oncology.
And this was 69% of patients who were terminally ill with lung cancer and 81% with colorectal cancer didn't understand that the chemotherapy they were receiving was not, in this case, to eliminate their tumors. It was given to buy them a little time or make them feel more comfortable, but it was really striking to look at the number of patients in this New England Journal article that didn't know the reason they were receiving the chemotherapy.
And on the surface, we would both probably say that's a little bit of a travesty or a big travesty, because even 2 months before they died, half of the patients with lung cancer had not heard their doctors use the word hospice. Of course, the interesting thing here, Christy, is that they reported that the patients who had really nice things to say about their doctors and the doctors communicating with them were the ones that were least likely to hear that they were so sick. If the doctor said, "You're so sick," the patients were more likely to say they didn't like that form of communication. What do we do?
Well, I think, you know, this is not about bad doctors. It's not about patients who are not intelligent. It's about that communication and that relationship. And in this case, hope is really important. But I also think it's important for people to be able to plan appropriately and make wise decisions about whether or not they even want to receive the chemotherapy if it's not going to make a difference in that, in the way that they're hoping.
So, and we probably need to have the conversation about both that expectations and that realism and that honesty with the hope.
Mm-hmm.
Great suggestions, Christy. Well, that'll conclude our Research That Matters. We've had a chance to talk about chemotherapy and hope and realism.
We've talked about the fight against obesity and whether or not limiting drink size is a good thing.
Certainly that we're definitely in form of laughter for all the right reasons.
And about cancer patients' hopes for chemotherapy.
That'll conclude the Research That Matters. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Barack Richman about patient bills, contracts, and consent. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Professor of Law at Duke Law School, Dr. Barack Richman, about an article he just wrote in the New England Journal of Medicine about patient bills, contracts, and consent. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Richman.
Thanks very much for having me.
You know, Dr. Richman, our listeners are surely interested in hearing how your path led you to write such an article. How did you become passionate about the ethical and legal aspects of patients receiving bills from doctors?
Well, the initial interest, I think, came in my capacity as a health economist. I, like many Americans, although evidently not the campaigns, the current presidential candidates, I'm deeply concerned about the amount of national expenditures we have to consume healthcare. It is putting businesses bankrupt. The private cost of insurance, or the cost of private insurance, is really cutting into both businesses' liquidity and also family incomes. And, of course, the public side, Medicare, is deeply threatened from going bankrupt. And, you know, the health economists will tell you that the primary problem is not that we're not taxing enough or not that we're being excessively generous as far as what we're covering. The primary problem is simply the cost, the individual prices of individual healthcare services. So I got interested in the process of billing, of charging price for services, really from this macroeconomic issue that we are going down an unsustainable path, and it is causing both private and public bankruptcies to really alter the economic trajectory of the nation.
Well, I think that our patients, our listeners out there, really understand this. I'm struck by two things, Dr. Richman, that one, maybe as providers, physicians, maybe we're immune from this sometimes because perhaps we don't have to, we tend to have really good health insurance, perhaps like you or professors and others, but our patients and my family members frequently have these incredible bills sometimes that you just wonder, you know, one day in the hospital, $8,000 to $10,000, and insurance may only cover a very small fraction of that. And like, where do you start?
Yeah, well, you know, I like the way you put it, Adam. There is a certain degree of befuddlement that comes with these bills, and there's a good reason for that. It's because it really doesn't make a lot of sense. So, you think you have insurance, and you see a bill, and sometimes most of it's covered, and sometimes it's not. But the point that you generally just look at the amount that you have to pay. The part nobody pays attention to is what bill, where the bill begins with, what the accounting bill is. And because nobody pays attention to it, because people really only look at what they need to pay, and similarly, insurers also only look at what they need to pay, that overall bill doesn't get the kind of scrutiny that it should get. So I began with this problem wondering about how these bills got to be so high, thinking that it was a matter of real national urgency. And I kind of came to the very basic conclusion that one reason they're so high is because they're not negotiated over. You know, the reason that we have price discipline in most markets is because the buyer and the seller negotiate over prices. And we just don't have that. We have third-party payers. We have complicated codes. We have a morass of hospital accounting practices that nobody can understand. And we get these bills that just cause befuddlement. We don't understand where they come from because, in large part, they don't come from the place that prices normally come from.
So help us understand. I mean, I what you're saying completely relates with me. I just got a letter in the mail saying that this service for my son's well child check several months ago has been denied. Doesn't say that I owe any money. I can't figure out what it means. So I empathize with this, the challenges there, but you're saying we can't understand it because it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Help us.
We can't understand it because there's nothing to understand.
It's not
and
rational.
I relate to that. To that instance, I mean, not only do I get bills that I, you know, for charges that I don't remember getting and for prices I certainly would never have agreed to, but I mean, this causes a lot of anxiety. It certainly brings a lot of people on the verge of bankruptcy. A lot of people go bankrupt because of healthcare bills, and a lot of those who go bankrupt because of healthcare bills still have insurance, but they just don't know what the cost of the services that they're getting are going to be.
And well, let's ask
I have
that.
A next-door neighbor who called me really in frantic, not knowing what to do with the bill, in large part because she just didn't understand it.
Well, before we get into some of the suggestions you have for trying to help this in your New England Journal of Medicine article, help us understand why is this the case in medicine. Christy and I, before you came on, we were talking about, you know, when the plumber comes to my house, unfortunately, just recently, I kind of know within a narrow range what I'm going to get charged, or they'll give me an estimate before they start the work. When I go to the lawyer for a closing for a house, I kind of know within a range that's what the bill's going to be for an hour of time. Why isn't it like that in medicine, or is it like that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. In some cases, in some fields, where there is a very small role for insurance, you think about a certain, for counseling, maybe for certain elective procedures, think of plastic surgery, sometimes for IVF treatment. Often those services are not covered by insurance, and you do see price transparency. You know, before the services is given, you see the provider quoting prices and the consumer, the patient, deciding among those procedures based on price in part. So we certainly see that it is possible in the world of healthcare to see a price negotiation and price-sensitive markets. But why is that why is that the exception than the rule? I think there are a couple reasons. And some of the reasons are distinctively bad reasons. That is, there are reasons that really demand redress, but some of them are good reasons, and that is the reasons we have to struggle with. Well, one bad reason, right, it might be a good reason actually, is the role of insurance. That is, the provider and the patient very rarely talk about prices because there is a third party that really assumes a financial burden. A related reason, which I think is a good reason, is that it's hard to talk about prices. In the doctor-patient relationship, there needs to be a primary commitment to the patient's health, the patient's well-being.
Because you're sick when you come in to see the doctor, you're not feeling good, and if all of a sudden you say, "Hey, by the way, for $620, I can make you better," maybe that upfront isn't the right way.
And part of the article's argument is that there has to be something in the front end to make it the right way, but it's tricky to do it. It's tricky to do that. Doctors and patients don't like talking about price. There is a sense that health is invaluable. And there's a good reason to think that health is invaluable because it certainly is nothing that you can buy at the Walmart. But we have a cultural distaste for commoditizing health and commoditizing healing. So for those reasons, discussion of dollars and cents are not part of that discussion. They're not traditionally part of that doctor-patient relationship.
So one of the things that's tricky for me is that in being in that physician role, it is hard to talk to my patients, even about the elective things like circumcision. It is hard to break through that. Well, if you want this and your insurance doesn't cover it, this is how much. I mean, part of the reason doctors got into this business is to just take care of people and not want to worry about that. And I wonder, as you've thought about this, what you've discovered as solutions to help overcome that barrier.
Well, that is the big challenge. And certainly, you know, there is... talking about dollars really does interfere with exactly that primary motivation to help and to heal. Having said that, there is a great emphasis in the medical profession on overall well-being, and certainly a patient's financial well-being has got to be part of that overall well-being. Similarly, there is a great commitment to patient consent. You would never dream of doing a procedure without the patient's consent. Well, part of the article argues that financial consent has to be part of that. You have to. It is an ethical obligation to make sure that the patient understands what financial consequences there will be. So there's no doubt that it is difficult. It's difficult for even though lawyers are very good at charging people, it's very difficult for a lawyer to talk about prices. It's a lot easier just to send a bill afterwards. But nonetheless, it is not only responsible, but I think ethically incumbent upon physicians to make sure that is a part of a patient's well-being. And that's also a part of the consent that is obtained before treatment is delivered.
Well, Dr. Richmond, speaking of ethical, it's ethically imperative that we take a short break. We're going to ask for your consent.
I consent.
Appreciate that. But when we come back, we're going to continue this really important conversation about patient bills, contracts, and consent. Stay with us. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Professor of Law at Duke Law School, Dr. Barack Richman, about patient bills, contracts, and consent. And before the break, Dr. Richman, you were explaining to us some of the barriers and reasons why billing and patient consent and understanding is so complex, and making a beautiful case for thinking about the overall well-being of our patients, including that financial well-being. But I wonder, as we talk about solutions, if you could give us an example of maybe a common scenario or the type of problem that comes up as we think about solutions.
Sure. So there are, you might say there are two kinds of solutions. Two kinds of problems. One problem is just the product of the complexity of our system, and arguably this is not an inherent problem. But there also is an intractable problem. So let's begin with the intractable problem. The article that you've mentioned begins with a hypothetical that is very, very common. A physician encounters an unconscious and dying patient that requires immediate medical attention. The physician provides life-saving care, revives the patient, and then sends a bill. Does the law or ought the law require the patient to pay the physician, even though the patient never explicitly consented to getting the treatment? Well, as you all know, as everyone should know, that is a service that should be reimbursed. The doctor should not be required to get consent from an unconscious and dying patient before providing care. In an emergency situation, in a life-threatening situation, we don't want to have consent at the front end to impede the delivery of life-saving care. But of course, that is the nature of the delivery of health care, not just an emergency basis, but also on routine basis, that we give care before talking about prices, in part because we don't have really the opportunity to talk about prices. A lot of services need to be provided before there can be a meaningful conversation, and sometimes, given the complexity of the science, the difficulty of conveying to the patient exactly what the procedure is, even if that conversation can happen, it doesn't mean that the patient can voluntarily consent because it's difficult. So there is an intractable problem in the delivery of healthcare to really obtaining a consent in the front end. And we have to recognize that.
Well, so I want to just go right with that for a second, because one of your solutions is to provide a market-based, or not your solutions, but one of the things you talk about could be a solution is to providing a market-based approach where providers put their fees right up front as you walk in the door, kind of like if you get a spa treatment. I'll call that the spa treatment approach.
Okay.
That would be a problem in the current situation when you need urgent care and you I mean, it wouldn't fit, right?
Well, that's exactly right. Although you could, you know, the argument, the reason you I think you accurately call it a market-based solution, is because if the market were working effectively, and it obviously cannot and does not, but if the market were perfect, the mere disclosure of prices in advance is enough to impute consent. That is, if a hospital has prices for all the things that they can charge, the only thing that they provide, if they have all those charges, all those prices online, then theoretically I could find out in advance and I would be informed by, you know, by going to the hospital or even by being injured near the hospital, I have effectively, not explicitly, but implicitly provided consent. That is one approach. It's the market approach. It's approach that really where it imposes upon the provider the obligation of disclosure, but nothing more.
Well, one of the things that's tricky about that, when a patient asks me and when we're talking about how much the MRI is going to cost or how much some element would cost, is the variation in prices, that there's not one set price for all people. It's based on their insurance, or if they don't have insurance, then there's a discount, and it gets extra confusing. So I wonder how you've addressed that in thinking about the other approaches.
Yeah, so disclosure and market-based solutions is severely limited, not just because of consent, but also because of inherent complexity, because different patients require different things. This is one move that some policymakers have moved towards to solving this lack of consent problem, this billing problem. But the article argues that we need to really push a lot farther. We need much more intervention into solving this problem. So a second solution would be essentially to have a doctrine of informed financial consent. That is, put upon the physician the obligation of not necessarily obtaining consent, but thinking about the patient's welfare in ascribing services. So this would be very much the physician assuming responsibility not just for the patient's physical welfare, but also for the economic welfare. This is a second solution. It's what we call the professionalism solution.
And that's why don't you meet with a financial counselor and find out exactly how much that'll be, and then we'll talk again about whether or not to do X, Y, or Z.
Well, this is a very legitimate counter to those who don't like the professionalism response. it's a very significant burden on physicians for things that are very difficult to do, and frankly, they haven't been trained to do.
Well, and increasingly, we are faced with this, particularly with our uninsured patients who come in, and we are now billing. They're going to receive bills, and so we have them meet with the financial counselor to review these elements, and it's very complex, and it's distasteful for many people in the environment, but it does do the consent. What about your third approach, though, which is price regulation?
That's right. The third is price regulation, which is the most interventionist. It's where the government really comes in, and price regulation means the government sets up prices. Now, in some senses, that's the easiest solution. It takes the burden off of getting the patient's consent. It takes the burden off of requiring the professional, the provider, the physician, from assuming these additional ethical and professional obligations. It also solves the problem of complexity. We all know what the prices are, and of course the price may not be exactly right. We might be able to incorporate some variation on you know, how difficult the particular patient is or how difficult the procedure is, but it's a uniform answer to a very severe problem. The downside, of course, is that, well, we believe in competition in this country. And when you set prices to the government, you are really impeding the provider's ability to improve quality, to reduce cost, to really position themselves in a meaningful way, and it also takes away patients' abilities to shop around. This really is the Soviet solution, there aren't a whole lot of problems in this country that for which Soviet solutions are attractive. But nonetheless, this is working in some senses. Hospital rate regulation is being adopted by some states, and it has effectively reduced the increase in healthcare expenditure costs.
And so
it is one viable solution.
And you have one fourth solution that's related to implied contracts. Break that down for us.
So the reason to the last solution is because it's the one that I find most attractive. So how do I solve the problem of the unconscious patient? You know, the article says this is a staple in every contracts class, every first-year law school curriculum. And I teach contracts, and this is how I was attracted to the problem, to this larger problem, because I see runaway healthcare expenditures. And I was attracted to the solution because of what happens in my contracts class. What do? We ask the question not whether consent was explicitly obtained, but whether, if there were a conversation, would have consent been obtained? Would the patient, the average patient, the normal patient, have said, yes, I want you to give me life-saving treatment right now? And if the answer is comfortably yes, of course, obviously there are Christian scientists who might say no, but if the average person, the average answer is yes, then we say there is an implied contract. There was consent was not explicitly obtained, but we can impute one. And using that same logic, we ask the basic question, would these billing prices have been agreed to? And you can say yes if it's what most people are paying. If insurance companies are negotiating with hospitals and they're agreeing to this price, then we can impute consent on the part of the individual patient. So it is a very simple and elegant legal solution to what I think is a really complicated policy problem.
Well, and I think that you're opening up the door, and I applaud you for your article, Dr. Richman, the New England Journal of Medicine. You're opening up the door and making something more transparent, or attempting to. And you know, I love your solutions, which I call the SPA approach, the surrogate approach, the Soviet approach, and then what you claim is the sensible approach.
Well done.
And the four S's approach to patient billing, but I will say that this transparency is admirable and something I think both Christy and I applaud.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us today.
That was my pleasure.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a few minutes to talk about your health questions and concerns, give you our take on it.
And you can send us your own questions at yourhealth@unc.edu. And Christy, we have some really good House Call questions today. One dealing with anxiety and medication.
One about hair falling out.
A third about an acute kidney infection called pyelonephritis. Hard to say and a little scary.
And the final one about skin cancer and follow-up.
Let's listen to our very first House Call, Christy, about one of our listeners who talking about anxiety.
If I have occasional acute anxiety problems, maybe once every month or two, should I consider taking an SSRI that my doctor recommends or a medication like Ativan that my friend recommends?
Well, I think the answer might be both. But I think it's important that you talk with your doctor about the differences between the SSRI, which is a medicine like Prozac or Zoloft or Paxil or a whole bunch of different ones. That's a daily medicine more for prevention of the anxiety attacks and of the anxiety versus the Ativan, which is more of a short-term kind of a
treats
fix.
The symptoms, but doesn't perhaps treat the underlying biology is how I like to think about it.
I sometimes like that too.
But it's interesting because some people would say neither, which I don't think Christy and I would say that, but some people would say, well, maybe if you're having it so intermittently that you should do behavioral treatments. And there are a whole host of behavioral treatments, so we're not ignoring those. But I think if you're having it, frequently enough, once or twice a month, then it is worth having this conversation with your doctor about this SSRI, just as you mentioned, Christy.
And I think it depends, too, on how, when you say anxiety problems, is that, you know, feeling a little anxious, or is that a full anxiety attack, or is that days of really suffering from anxiety? Part of it depends on how much it's impacting your life. And sort of as you weigh that out with a potential benefit and the cost and the potential side effects from taking medication.
Yeah, I had someone, Christy, once told me they needed to drive on the highway every day to go to work, but the thought of getting on the highway caused an anxiety attack. And of course, getting on the highway, well, that's not one you want to wait till you're on that highway and you get that anxiety attack. That's someone we really had to work with. And so thanks for your question. It's a really good one. And let's listen to our very next house call.
I was told recently I had a condition called telogen effluvium. The doctor said it was likely due to stress. How long will it last and what can I do? My hair is falling out every day.
Telogen effluvium. Well, that's hard to say. That's a hard to say. And it really means hair loss kind of all over your scalp. It's a scary sort of thing.
And the literature would say that your doctor was right in that sometimes it is sort of a stressful event or a new medication or some sort of factor that's contributing to stress and your hair falling out. But there is some good news.
Well, the good news is that this usually resolves and the hair will grow back. And the kind of the flip side of that, though, is that we don't always figure out what's causing it. You know, whether it is due to a stressful event or medication, we will sometimes check a thyroid test or your iron levels to see if we can correct those things. But while it's happening, it's really frustrating and it can make people really kind of sad. So we really want to help support you in that, in addition to maybe some different hair products and some other medications that could maybe be used.
So in addition to trying to find the stressful event and decrease that stress, there are thickening agents. There's minoxidil, other hair growth options that can at least help temporize it or help thicken it up as your hair is trying to regrow.
And we'll ask our health sciences librarians to put a link up on our site about this non-scarring, this type of hair loss that does grow back, and that's the good news. Thank you so much for your question. Let's listen to our next house call, Christy.
I had pyelonephritis recently, but I'm fine now. My doctor said it's really dangerous. If I had it once, do I need x-rays of my kidney?
Pyelonephritis. So we should probably start with what is that?
And even spelling it. That's a hard one because it doesn't spell it like it sounds.
No, it is
P-Y-E, pyelonephritis.
Yes, which is, you know, a lot of people have heard of a UTI or urinary tract infection, but pyelonephritis is when that infection then travels up your urinary tract into your kidneys.
It's when that doctor pounds on your side and you're like, why are you beating on me? And it's because they're checking your kidneys, and that's where your kidneys are located, in that right and left kind of lateral, the around your waist.
And when you get that pyelonephritis, it can make people very sick. Typically, you have a fever and chills. And particularly as you're older, that bacteria can get into your blood, and the elderly, when they get kidney infections like this, can sometimes get very, very ill.
And whether or not you need x-rays of your kidney, like an ultrasound or a CAT scan or some other study, is really probably a conversation you should have with your doctor. It may be just one of these, depending on how severe it was, might lead you to have it. On the other hand, if you have bladder infections pretty frequently, this might be something, if it weren't too serious, you might say, okay, I don't need to expose myself, or your doctor may not recommend that you have a test. So talk with your doctor about this, but a great question. Thanks so much.
Really great question. Okay, let's take our next house call about skin cancer.
I had two skin cancers. one on my arm 5 years ago, and one on my back last year. My doctor said I should come in every 6 months for a skin check now. Is that really necessary?
Let's take a vote on that, Christy. What do you say? I know what you're going to say.
You know what I'm going to say.
You're going to say yes, and I'm going to say yes, too.
Well, you know, and this is near and dear to me. I've shared this on the show before that my father passed away at 47 from melanoma, which is a type of skin cancer. And so I'm one of those people who has to follow. Now I'm back to every year, but often. And, yeah, it's a pain to go in every 6 months. But if you've had two skin cancers, then your doctor's really trying to keep a close watch on you. And so I think in this case, that's not true for everybody. Everybody doesn't need a skin check that often, but for you, I would.
And hopefully after a couple times, perhaps of every 6 months, if you haven't seen anything, maybe you can stretch that back out again. And by the way, use sunscreen.
Yeah, stay out of the sun. Okay, we've had great questions about anxiety.
About this telogen effluvium.
About pyelonephritis.
And about skin cancer and seeing your doctor. We want to thank you for joining us today on Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to us. You can follow us at yourhealthradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or our iTunes app.
We want to thank the staff of WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, the Health Physicians Library, who are helping us with our blog, and our guest today, Dr. Barack Richman. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll talk with you again next week. Can't wait. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.